From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Snyder sends his strongest signal yet. He'd like to add LGBT rights to Michigan's civil rights law.
I don't believe in discrimination. I think it would be great if they actually, the legislature, looked at the issue later in the year.
We talked to the governor from the Mackinac Policy Conference about this and other issues, plus fighting mental illness with a smartphone.
So the idea is that if we can identify individuals in sufficient time to intervene and prevent an episode, that would be the success.
And advice for job seekers, boost up your online presence.
The most important thing they want to see is a story of what you're passionate about, a story of what you've done, a story of your skills.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. We are about to mark the 5-year anniversary of a landmark day in American business history, the day General Motors filed for bankruptcy. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, we take stock of how GM has fared since that dramatic day in 09. Then, in this fast-paced digital world, is there still a place for that one-page resume and cover letter? Just what should job seekers do in order to catch that headhunter's eye? That's later in the hour. But first, it's day two of the Mackinac Policy Conference, where business leaders, entrepreneurs, and lawmakers are gathering with many issues top of mind, like raising the state's minimum wage and state money to Detroit. Also, just this morning, Governor Snyder sent the strongest signal yet that he would look favorably on adding LGBT rights to Michigan's civil rights law. Governor Snyder joins us now to talk about all of these issues. Governor, earlier today, we heard from a group of top Michigan business leaders pushing for LGBT rights to be added to the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act. You say you want the legislature to take it up, but is this something you will actually endorse?
Well, I appreciate them bringing up the issue, and as I've said, I don't believe in discrimination. I think it would be great if they actually, the legislature, looked at the issue later in the year.
Minimum wage, you signed the legislation. It got a very fast track through the House and Senate, much faster, might I add, than your request for money to fix the roads. We'll have to make that note. But there are leaders from both sides of the aisle saying they're happy to see the minimum wage rise to $9.25, but you do have members of your own party saying they think this is going to cause jobs to be lost and it will hurt Michigan's economy. What is your response to that?
Well, this was a good bipartisan compromise, and I appreciate it. This was a case where the leadership of both chambers and both parties, we all came together and said there should be a good, better solution here. And we all believed it, so we worked hard to come out with a good balance. And I think it came out with a good policy balance to say this is an opportunity to raise wages at the same time to do it in a fashion where we can, you know, appreciate the employer's concern about job creation.
And we have had Michigan citizens saying, please get bipartisan, please try to pull together and work together for the good of the state. So you see this as a good example of that.
It's a very good example. And the good part is it builds on what the House did with the Detroit settlement. That was another good bipartisan effort that actually I think the vote count totals in that case in particular surprised people about how strong the support was across all of Michigan to resolve the Detroit situation.
But I do have to ask what you would say to the some 300,000 Michiganders who signed those petitions to put the 10-10 question on the November ballot and basically let voters decide. Because the people who signed those petitions were not outsiders, as some GOP leaders describe them. They're Michigan voters who feel they've been shut down in this rush to kill the ballot proposal. Tell me, why shouldn't they feel cynical and angry?
Well, you mentioned the people signing the petitions, but prior you mentioned some people, primarily Republicans, that might not like the solution. This is part of a process to say this is a good policy answer, and it involved compromise and bipartisan effort, and the legislators were doing their job in terms of here's a difficult policy issue, here was a way to work it out in a constructive fashion where people did get a raise. So the outcome was one where people will be getting raises and getting raises over a consistent period of time in a structural solution, with also some limitations to deal with cases that concerned employers about it wouldn't be too much in any one year and also would be dealt with if there was too much unemployment. So this is the way I would hope the system would work in terms of people working well together and understanding there's a balance.
Let's go to Detroit, Governor. What are you hearing now as you're on Mackinac, you're working through the crowds, you're talking to a lot of people? How much support are you sensing there is for the grand bargain and how much resistance?
Well, with the people up here at Mackinac, there's tremendous support for the grand bargain. And I think I found that in many cases across the state. This is a case where we have to do something really special. If you stop and think about it, and the situation I often give people, for many Michiganders, when you talk to somebody out of state, how much of that discussion, the first 5 or 10 minutes, was about people out of state bringing up problems in Detroit before you could talk about what you wanted to talk about? And if you think about it, that's been true most of our lives for many of us. And we have a situation by this fall where that part of that discussion could go away, that the discussion could then be one about people talking about Detroit's comeback and about growing Detroit. And that's something that I think has positive, powerful positive impact to every Michigander, because I think we very often have lived through that discussion, that old discussion, for far too long.
What kind of impression did you think Mike Duggan made yesterday, the mayor of Detroit, as he was there before the conference? Do you think he said what was needed?
Yeah, I think he gave a good presentation. It's a very pragmatic one, with measurements and metrics. I'm a big measurement and metrics person. It was important issues like blight, jobs for young people, emergency response times, a number of topics that, when you look at the issues in Detroit, a lot of these are the fundamental things. Let's get the lights on. Let's get the trash picked up. Let's get better public safety. Let's be a safer, better city. And he addressed those in many ways. That's why, in fact, I made the point of being in his presentation to listen to it.
Do you think this bankruptcy can be wrapped up before the clock runs out on Kevin Orr's term as emergency manager?
I hope so. Again, that's always been the goal, and it's been a very aggressive timetable, but we've done well. If you go back and look at over a year ago when the first timetable was set, we're within a couple weeks of that, which I don't think anybody really expected that. Most people were highly skeptical of that, and we've gotten a lot of great things done. We'll work through this process. And again, the important thing is we get it resolved, because, again, I want to see the mayor and the city council running the city of Detroit on their own as soon as possible with some good oversight.
One of the big problems that's kind of hanging out there is what to do with Detroit's water and sewer department. What are your thoughts as far as the best answer to that problem?
Well, I've always contended I thought it would be good to look at a regional authority in some fashion, because it's providing services to the region. And so I think there was a lot of effort made by Kevin Orr to get that worked out early on. Those talks were not successful. And I think it's good that mediators have now been appointed to continue the dialogue. What I would say is all the discussion on water and sewer should not interfere with the grand bargain in terms of what the Senate's looking at. We should get the grand bargain done, I would hope, through the Senate, and then have ongoing discussions about the best way to do the water system.
Well, you know Brooks Patterson, Oka County exec. He's a tough old politician who's seen it all. And we also have Macomb County exec Mark Hackle, and they both are worried people in their counties are really going to carry the cost of Detroit's rescue in terms of much higher water rates. Can they be won over to this idea of a regional water authority?
Well, we've been providing them additional information, because those aren't the facts. The facts are that if you look at it, it's nearly $500 million of savings for ratepayers with the current plan of adjustment. And in fact, all that they're talking about is an acceleration of payments that would already be required by ratepayers. So it's the simple case of, if you had a 30-year mortgage or a 10-year mortgage, aren't you better off with a 10-year mortgage? It might cost you a little bit more in those years, but you actually save money. So in addition to that $500 million, it's actually a better deal for ratepayers.
I want to look ahead to the November election. At this point, it seems that you are not wanting to take on your Democratic opponent, Mark Schauer, in a very direct way. And we know you do like to think of yourself as not political. But I'm wondering, do you plan to engage in a direct campaign against Mark Schauer? I mean, I'm wondering, at what point is it time to get political and fight for your job?
Well, again, I'm running on my record. I'm governor of Michigan. I'm proud of it. I'm being governor. And I think that's what people want me to do. So the way I view it is, again, people have their expectations. They like campaigns where people fight back and forth. I don't fight with people. I believe in relentless positive action. I'm proud of my record. I'm going to keep solving problems in Michigan, and I hope our voters respect that.
Governor, thanks so much for your time and talking with us on Stateside.
No, it's great to be with you. Take care.
Let's stay on Mackinac for a moment and turn now to Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. His column today is all about Rick Snyder shaking up political stereotypes. And Daniel, we can't be surprised at the thumbs up for the governor that you're getting from Republicans and from business leaders. But I want you to tell us about your conversation with former member of the Detroit City Council, Sheila Cockrell. What did she say about the governor?
Well, I think she basically says he's done the right thing. He refused to kick the can down the road. He recognized the dire financial straits that Detroit was in and was willing to take the political risk to try and fix it, and it ultimately culminated in the largest municipal bankruptcy in American history. I think the governor, he said something interesting yesterday when we were interviewing him. He said, "I've been working on Detroit since 2009. Now, listeners will remember, he was elected in 2010, so that suggests clearly that he was looking at the macroeconomic environment, the political corruption problems of the city, and kind of figured that if he was elected governor, this was going to land on his desk, and it did. And I think Sheila Cockrell just recognizes that he did the right thing, and I think that's a very important distinction here that is confounding a lot of conventional political thinkers, and mm-hmm. that is that a Republican governor and a Republican legislature are engineering, if you will, the redemption of Detroit and the restructuring of Detroit. And that's very hard for people to get their minds around.
Yeah, as we just heard in my conversation with the governor, he really, really, really is Mr. Relentless Positive Action. And he doesn't and he will not fling bricks and mud, for example, at his Democratic opponent, Mark Schauer. He doesn't wreak vengeance. How do you see this style of his as proving to be more of an asset than a liability?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is that it creates, and I don't like this word necessarily, but it creates inclusiveness, the likes of which traditional partisan approaches do not. I think there are a lot of people that are looking at the results and looking at an administration that is trying to create solutions instead of waging the same old tired battles. And I think that even confounds the media a little bit in Michigan and nationally because they're more accustomed to the traditional partisan back and forth. And that's really not what we have. And I think one of the things that the governor is doing is he tends to treat people just as people. And he accepts the fact that they may disagree, but let's try and find common ground. Let's try and agree that we need a solution, and let's move towards on that solution. That said, he's not unwilling to push ahead with things that are very unpopular and are opposed by others. But I think that's what gives him high marks, because I think also a lot of people know that Detroit had been doing the same thing over and over again and somehow expecting a different result, and they weren't getting it.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House checking in from the Mackinac Policy Conference. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The graduation ceremonies are over. Caps and gowns stuffed in the back of the closet and the photos of college grad and proud family members posted on Facebook and Instagram. Now comes reality for new college grads, the job search. And in this digital world packed with social media, the old-fashioned one-page resume and cover letter might not cut it anymore. Just what do recruiters and companies want to see from applicants? For some advice, we turn to someone who's been a career counselor for some 15 years at the University of Michigan School of Information, where she's the Director of Career Development. Joanna Kroll, welcome.
Thanks, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
So this one-page resume and cover letter that used to do the trick is no longer enough?
It is and it isn't. I'll put it that way. It is still standard resumes and cover letters are really the first place employers go to. That's what they expect in an application. But they're looking for more now. So if you want to really pique their interest, you have to show that you've got some savvy. You understand the role that technology plays in recruiting these days. And the trend in recruiting these days really indicates that recruiters really across all industries are becoming more strategic about how to uncover hidden talent faster. The biggest problem employers are facing is that they can't find students or graduates with the exact skill set who have that right fit, that right personality, the competencies that they need in a fast enough way.
Hmm.
So in this fast-paced digital world, recruiters are really looking for accomplished talent beyond looking at traditional resumes and cover letters. They want to evaluate and assess talent on a deeper, more strategic and holistic level faster. And
but, yeah, faster was the word there.
Yeah, faster. And we're hearing that over and over, which is great for our students to hear, like, the economy is doing better. There's opportunities out there. Where the struggles are is finding the right talent that they need, that the employers need, in a fast enough way.
So what should job seekers prepare in order to catch that headhunter's eye? Because it sounds like what I'm hearing from you is we need depth, we need to show the employer that we can do the job, and we need to be able to serve that up quickly.
Absolutely. So they're really looking for them. Recruiters are really turning to an online presence. So it is critical pretty much for all new grads to have some sort of online presence, and I mean more than having their personal Facebook page and their Twitter accounts and Instagrams. A professional online presence is critical. Employers, they want to see, whether it be a more technical online portfolio that's developed by a candidate that can get deeper at some of this, at their skills and evidence of projects and work that they've done, leadership opportunities, service work they've done, volunteer work they've done as college students. That all makes a difference and fits into what they're looking for holistically. And so a resume and cover letter can't often go into that depth. But if you've piqued their interest with a good cover letter and resume, they're going to go online to look for your presence there.
So what kind of presence? Yeah. Give me an idea, Joanna. Yeah. When we say this e-portfolio, yeah. What should be up there?
Okay, so a professional e-portfolio should really, you want to show a potential employer who you are. So you want to show a little bit about your personality. You want to include things like some of your hobbies and interests so they can sort of get that holistic view of you as a person. But they also want to see, the most important thing they want to see is a story of what you're passionate about, a story of what you've done, a story of your skills, and any sort of work experience that you've had. So the way that you do that is by not making it all crazy fancy, but still keeping it very clean, professional looking, that makes it very intuitive for the user to click to things that you're passionate about and projects that you've worked on and other experiences such as community work or volunteer work or study abroad that can go deeper. And so there's a lot of different platforms for ePortfolio. So even for the non-tech savvy, there's ways that you can create an ePortfolio by using social media such as LinkedIn. LinkedIn is becoming one of the most popular tools recruiters are turning to find talent faster. And so having a professional LinkedIn portfolio is really the easiest way to have a sort of online presence, to start that e-portfolio presence.
And I would suspect who you have as your LinkedIn contacts, mm-hmm. you probably want to be judicious in who you accept LinkedIn invitations from.
Absolutely. And who you're connected with, who your first and second round connections are. But, most importantly for employers, they don't have a lot of time to spend sort of digging through an online portfolio. Oh. So make it easy on them. They've gone to your online portfolio because you've piqued their interest in your resume and cover letter. They see, oh, this candidate has the qualifications, but I want to see more about who they are and what motivates them and what they're passionate about. And that's when they'll go to an online portfolio, such as going to a LinkedIn profile. So make sure what you have on there really captures their eye. It's not too texty. But it really draws out what you're passionate about, what your strengths are, and what motivates you.
Is this right for everyone, or are there fields where all of this with video resumes or personal websites might not be right?
I don't think it's right or wrong. I don't think it could hurt you. Mm-hmm. But there are certainly fields where it's really becoming more of a requirement. So more of the creative fields, design agencies, they want to see evidence of your design skills, of your creativity. So they're going to turn to an online portfolio. That will be an expectation. And more universities are catching on to that, and they're actually having students develop portfolios as their students and carry those portfolios with them as they leave electronically. So, for those fields, it's becoming more of a requirement. For other fields, it's not a requirement, but employers are open to it. Most say they're receptive to looking at a video resume. They don't want that to be the only thing, though. Again, mm-hmm. the standard must come first.
But it certainly seems like a good, clean, well-put-together LinkedIn page.
Yes.
Or a personal website. After you've gotten your killer one-page resume and wonderful cover letter.
Absolutely.
It's a tall mountain to climb. As these graduates are preparing all of this, mm-hmm. I'm wondering what advice you would give in terms of the mindset as they seek their dream job. Should we start with probably the fact there is no dream job?
No. I always the way I work with my students from day one is I want you thinking about that dream job. We're shooting for the stars here. You're preparing for that. You're investing in that with your education. That's what you deserve. And so we really start talking about it from day one. I want them to shoot for their dream job, but they have to put in the legwork. They have to commit to that. And it doesn't, we don't have a drawer full of jobs that we just hand to them. Gone are the days of placement, of placing students in jobs. That doesn't happen anymore. What we do, at least here at the University of Michigan, is we develop students to be effective job seekers for a lifetime. They need to be in control of that process. So we really help them along the way with all these tools and all this knowledge to help them get there. We provide them with the toolkit, but they really have to commit to putting in the legwork. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of networking. There's a lot of competition out there. But with the right materials, with a strong resume, cover letter, and that portfolio can just help sort of get them over the edge and get them into that dream job faster.
Joanne Kroll, Director of Career Development at the University of Michigan School of Information. Thanks for the advice, Joanne. It was great speaking with you.
Thanks, Cindy.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive, it's alive!
It's the sound of science!
The National Institute of Mental Health tells us some 5.7 million American adults struggle with bipolar disorder. Now, a critical part of managing this disorder is the ability to sense when the mood swings are about to happen, something the patient isn't usually aware of, and to get the patient into a physician straight away for help. A research team at the University of Michigan is now working on a smartphone program called Priori. It detects mood swings through voice analysis of phone conversations, even before patients know that something's up. Dr. Melvin McInnes is one of the researchers. He's a psychiatrist and a bipolar specialist. Dr. McInnes, very good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Now, we know this app is still being developed. Tell us what it does.
Well, this is a program, an application, if you will, that resides on a mobile device on a smartphone. And it's not really an app in the sense that we have apps that you download an app and put them on a smartphone or on a device. Rather, it's a program. And it's a program that collects the outgoing speech of an individual while they're speaking over the course of their normal activities during the day using the phone. And the program packages, encrypts the speech, and then sends it to a central server where it's analyzed centrally.
And what can it tell you?
Well, what we're hoping that it will tell us is that there are features of speech, the acoustics of speech, mm-hmm. that associate with mood changes. And ultimately, we hope that these changes can be identified early on in the emergence of a particular mood state, a pathological mood state in bipolar disorder or depression, that would predict an impending pathological mood state, predict a depression, predict a mania.
And then as a psychiatrist, you could intervene. That would be the idea.
Correct.
Before
so,
someone goes careening off the cliff.
So one of the most problematic features of the manic phase in bipolar disorder is that the individual loses their insight. In other words, they start revving up, getting excited, euphoric, talking faster and feeling that they're on top of the world, and they don't see that there's a problem ensuing. And so before they know it, something untoward can happen. And so we're hoping that we can identify changes in the mood prior to it becoming apparent to the individual, prior to it causing problems, and in that phase wherein the individual would say, oh, thank you very much. I appreciate the point that there is a 60, 70, or 80% chance that I'll develop a manic episode, and yes, we should try and get this under control.
Now, how did this idea evolve, Doctor?
So this idea evolved really from talking to my patients and talking to the families of my patients, and one of the characteristic things that I hear from families all the time is that they will say to me, you know, there's something going wrong. There's something wrong with my family member because I can just hear it in their voice. And so that they pick up the phone or they listen to them and the individual only has to say three or four words or three or four sentences before they know, bam, there's something going wrong.
Okay.
And it's akin to, you know, a family member contacting their college student and, you know, the student says, you know, three or four sentences and the mom says, what's wrong, son?
Mm-hmm. It's true. You know that your spider sense goes off.
Exactly.
Right away.
Exactly. So the idea is that if we can identify individuals in sufficient time to intervene and prevent an episode, that would be the success of such a program, of such a application. And so it's prioritizing the individuals for health care and prioritizing them in a way that would get them in to their doctor at an appropriate time to intervene and prevent an episode.
So as you're testing this program, where does the data go? What data is collected? And you say it's encrypted, so privacy concerns are met. And where does that data go?
Yes. So it's important to appreciate the testing part about this. So this is a research program, as it is right now. And it's here with this College of Engineering here at the University of Michigan in a collaboration with the Department of Psychiatry. My research team here that is sponsored by the Prechter Bipolar Research Fund here at the University of Michigan. And so we are engaging individuals with rapid cycling bipolar disorder, and we are testing to see if we can use a process that uses just the phone in a way that the individual is using their phone over the course of the day.
Sure.
So an individual could engage to be monitored, and it's being monitored without them necessarily being monitored. So as it is right now, this is a consent form that the individuals sign and participate in our research.
Sure.
But going forward, we hope that we'll have a sufficiently encrypted process, and then it's sent in an encrypted manner to a central server where the engineers analyze it.
And then loop back to the physician, back to the patient, maybe family members if they're on board with it?
Yes, to loop back to someone who's identified that could help them intervene.
Yeah.
And say, it'd be a good idea for you to see your doctor.
Okay. Let's talk about the prospects of other conditions.
Right. Well, there are many illnesses that speech is affected. So you just think about, for example, cancers. So a cancer of the throat or the neck and throat, lung cancers, or any disease that affects the respiratory system, cardiovascular system. When someone goes into congestive heart failure, for example, their speech will change. They'll become short of breath. Many neurological diseases can be affected in that. So speech and acoustics may be one of the best, if you will, biological markers that we have. And so it may be very helpful in predicting someone's state of health.
Of the group, you've got about how many patients being part of this study?
So we have this project started about a year and something ago. And so we've been monitoring around 10 individuals now over the past year. So we have nearly 1,000 hours of acoustic data gathered from these individuals. And so we have another 15 mobile devices deployed at the present moment, and we're testing new devices to work with. So we have a small number of individuals, but to emphasize, this is a research project, and we have to do proof of principle in the first instance. But the preliminary data are looking pretty good.
When you can see the numbers that come from the engineers and then see your patient and realize, indeed.
Yes, absolutely.
It's coming. So you see that there's a lot of potential here.
There's potential here.
What do the patients think about this?
Well, most individuals that have an unpleasant form of bipolar disorder, the type that we're studying right now is called rapid cycling. And so these individuals are experiencing a number of episodes over the course of a year. And so they're very grateful that we are focusing on methods and integrating technology into helping them to devise approaches to help them monitor their disorder. So there's nothing that they would like more than to not have these episodes, these pathological swings of mood. And so some people will just tell you, listen, I'd give anything to not have to go through this.
So the idea that this program could be on smartphones in the future, how far in the future do you think?
We're hoping that in working at the interface between industry and academia that we'll be able to expand our efforts and identify strategies to test this further and see how well it works and how adaptable it would be, how folks would embrace it. It may be that folks would say, gosh, this is too much of an invasion of our privacy, which we would respect. But I'm sure that there are individuals who would say, if there's a way to help me, please,
and
bring it on.
And Priori could be it.
I'm hoping.
Dr. Melvin McGinnis is a psychiatrist and a bipolar specialist with the University of Michigan research team working on this program that they say they're finding, as this early research finds, that those early voice changes could predict mood swings. Very exciting research, and we look forward to hearing more about it, Doctor. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Still to come, 5 years later, what have we learned from GM's bankruptcy? And what was the cost to taxpayers? Was it really worth it? That comes up next. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. At 8 a.m. Eastern Time, June 1st, 2009, General Motors filed for Chapter 11 reorganization. That filing in federal bankruptcy court in Manhattan was the start of a painful and historic journey for General Motors. 5 years later, following a massive government equity investment, General Motors is doing well, although it has been rocked recently by the ignition recall switch controversy and a blizzard of other recalls. More on that in a moment. But first, let's take stock of what GM's done in these past 5 years and ask the question, was the prevention of job and income losses worth the cost to taxpayers? Sonari Glinton is NPR's business reporter. Hello, Sonari.
Hello.
And Michigan Radio's auto reporter, Tracy Samilton. Always good to have you on, Tracy.
Good afternoon.
Well, all government-held shares in GM and Chrysler, we should add, are now sold. And U.S. taxpayers booked an almost $12 billion loss. So the obvious question, was it worth it, Sonari?
I don't think I'm qualified to say whether or not it's worth it. But if you think about the large sort of net that it was a part of as a part of TARP, the entire TARP investment has made money. And there's still people who are annoyed about the amount of money that the government spent to bail out banks as well as to bail out General Motors and Chrysler as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, politically, it did well for the president. But there's still some people who think that this might not have been the right place to go.
There are those people, but the consensus is they're wrong. There's a wide consensus even among economists who normally are hands off the market. I was unable to find any but one economist during the time of the bankruptcy who said we should just let the company go. So most economists said we don't want the government meddling with things unless it's a matter of a company this size going down, essentially possibly taking the entire U.S. economy with it, certainly taking the auto industry down with it for an extended period of time. So, yeah, there are people who are always going to resent that, but people who understand what it probably would have done all say this was a bargain. The amount of money we lost on this on this bankruptcy was nothing compared to what the cost would have been had we not done it.
And I think it's been well established, the fact that here you had the nation in the worst economic slump since the Great Depression and car sales were in a complete free fall. There really was no other option, was there, besides letting it die?
There were no sources of financing for the bankruptcy. The banks had shut down on lending. Certainly they didn't have the amount of money that GM needed, which was about $50 billion.
I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, but there are other ways that bankruptcy could have gone. And that is sort of, if you use, you know, what Mitt Romney would have said, a different sort of structured bankruptcy. People in the auto industry look at it and say, yes, this saved General Motors. It's doing well. It's doing better. But I think that it created this tremendous ill will for not only the government, the president. I mean, you can say that the Tea Party in part was because of one of these bailouts, that people were so angry at how much money these too big to fail is a thing that people don't really like. And especially when it's a company like General Motors, that's a part of what was going on. And to deny that, you know, a lot of the political retribution that came behind TARP, all of it, the whole kit and caboodle of it, is to deny something that people across the country, including in Michigan as well, sort of are more than annoyed with, you know, in terms of how our government is involved in our economy.
That is true. GM was definitely a political football during the last presidential campaign, and it was not pleasant for them at all to be in that position. And they didn't have a good image before the bankruptcy, and certainly being bailed out by the government just made that worse.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Samilton and NPR's business reporter Sonari Glinton as we look back at the five-year anniversary coming up on June 1st of General Motors filing for Chapter 11. All right. What has GM done right in these past 5 years? Sonari, go.
they make better cars. I think that that's the one real thing. If you'd asked me 15 years ago or 10 years ago, hey, what car am I going to buy? You know, I would have. This was before I was an auto reporter, but I would say, you know, you want to buy a this or that. But a General Motors car probably wouldn't have gotten on my list unless you're talking about a giant SUV. And now you have to consider a General Motors vehicle for a good number of the categories. Large sedan, definitely. Luxury car, definitely. Those are places where I don't necessarily think you would have thought of. And so when you look at the exciting offerings, which is what really this is about, that's where General Motors is doing well, is that when you're excited to hear about a new GM vehicle, because since the ghosts of bankruptcy have sort of gone away, mm-hmm. when the new products have come out, they've been pretty exciting. And that's the most surprising thing, I think, about the entire story, is that General Motors makes good cars and that they keep making more exciting ones. And that's kind of an amazing story to me.
They're getting recognized for it also. Consumer Reports chose the Impala as the best sedan last year. The best. Better than anything.
Not the best American.
Yeah,
that's right.
The best.
You know, it's something to be proud of. And they have some... they're moving into Volkswagen's territory now with a diesel version of the Cruze. So they have ambitions, and I've driven the diesel Cruze, and it's a very fine vehicle. They really are making better cars.
And how have things changed inside?
That
corporate climate, has that bankruptcy wrought changes that were needed, Tracy?
Well, I think they have a lot more work to do there. I think you see some good signs. They have taken their customer service center and insourced it now. They used to shop that out. Now that's their baby. They have GM people overseeing the folks who are answering the phones and trying to keep the customer satisfied. They have a new focus on pleasing the customer. It's not just GM, you will buy our cars. You know, they recognize that they're in competition here and they have to convince you. And, you know, they have insourced their IT. But Mary Barra, just in her last town hall meeting with employees, said, you know, we still have this culture of fear where people are afraid to bring bad news to their boss, and we can't have that. And so she's still dealing with this problem that has been something GM's dealt with for, you know, a couple of decades. So they have some work to do.
Sonari?
You know what I think is interesting is that General Motors seems to have solved a lot of the problems for a company in 1998. But what is really sort of concerning to me is that the auto industry as a whole isn't – it's not that it's General Motors has to compete against Ford. It has to compete against everything else. Mm. It has to compete against Apple. It has to compete against – for not just for, you know, your care of, you know, getting you to want to buy a vehicle that is, you know, half a year's salary, but just your attention, and for the best people, the thinkers who are coming into the industry. I mean, I feel like General Motors, and this is my feeling about the auto industry in general, that it's still stodgy. It's still with a female head, it's still really male oriented, where the customers are overwhelmingly women. It's there be a lot of these problems that are 2015, 2025 problems that I feel like General Motors hasn't gotten around to like looking at. But that said, I don't think that the entire auto industry has gotten around to looking at the 2025 problems. And so it's a better company than it was 5 years ago. But is it the company that it needs to be? I really don't think so.
I would say, Sonari, that to me, that is also a problem. It's a problem facing GM for sure, but I think it's also facing Ford and Chrysler, where there's this concept that car companies are not high tech, and I'm going to go to where, you know, I'm going to have exciting projects.
Where the cool things are happening.
Yeah, where the cool things, and where the main city in the state is not in bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And so it is a problem for General Motors, and And now because of the recalls, of course, they really have their work cut out for them.
And let's circle back to, Tracy, that comment about the climate of fear, that idea of shooting the messenger. And from that, don't we dovetail right into this ignition switch disaster? Could this derail the momentum that we've seen build over 5 years?
I think it will.
I
think it will. We are getting word that May auto sales for General Motors, as opposed to the rest of the industry, will only be up by a few percentage points. It's going to be the best month since 2007 for most other U.S. automakers. So I think these recalls are finally trickling into the consciousness of people who are, do I go to Ford? Do I go to Chrysler or do I go to GM? Do I go to Toyota? They're crossing, you know, those people who are not GM, you know, loyalists are going to be crossing GM off their list. So, and I think we are seeing some signs that that is going to happen. And another thing that's going to happen with GM is the cost of these recalls. They have recalled more than 13 million cars worldwide. It's going to eat up their profits this year. And unless they pour everything they can into product development, they're going to have trouble keeping up that momentum with the great vehicles that Sonari mentioned. They are developing them. They have to keep it up. They can't stop spending money on their next products.
I have to say that I don't necessarily see the – I mean, 1 month's auto sales, even though the summer autos are the most important time for selling. I think when you think about how much damage gets done to a brand because of a recall, even with the disastrous Toyota recall, Toyota still it rebounded. It had some troubles because of some other things as well. You know, an earthquake and tsunami came, you know, on the heels of that recall. However, I think that General Motors is handling it a lot differently than the last two recalls. And what people notice when they hear about recalls is, how are you responding? Are you taking responsibility? Are you blaming the customer for a problem? And I haven't necessarily seen signs that General Motors is doing those things. And, you know, a lot of this bad information, I mean, for those of us who live in the recall world, it seems like, oh, my God, every time there's some bad news. But to the guy on the street, as long as it's compressed and as long as this doesn't play out for years or months and months and the bad news. And I think that the worst of the news sort of happened a month or so ago or 2 months ago. We see surveys that show that people won't punish a brand just because they have a recall. The problem, I think, is the longer it plays out, if it plays out into the summer, if it goes into the winter, if there isn't a quick resolution of this, then it could be a problem. But I don't see this being in the headlines by December. I think that there is a real desire at General Motors to get this done, get it over with, and move forward. And I think if it does that in a truncated amount of time, I think that it can. And I don't think that it will be sort of this lasting scar for the company. I mean, Ford had one of the worst recalls in history. Toyota had one of the worst recalls in history. And both of those companies rebounded and learned some good lessons. And the auto industry learned some great lessons from it as well.
And knowing that this recovery is a work in progress, so separate from the ignition switch and the recall issue, what do you see as some of the challenges GM faces? Let's talk about profit margins in North America. Has GM weaned itself off that addiction to discounts and incentives, Tracy?
Yes. Yes.
And it needed to do that.
They had 1 month last year where everyone was like, oh, they're going back to their bad old ways.
I remember
when
that.
It seemed
like
their incentives were going up. But they have been tremendously disciplined about this. We haven't seen any signs that they are leading the pack. They're kind of in the middle in terms of the incentives. And they are, for the first time ever, willing to let market share go to protect profitability. And that's where they have to be. And they understand that. So, yeah, and their market share is going to go down this month. But that does not mean they're going to, I see no signs they're going to just say, oh, we have to get that market share back. Let's have some sales.
Last thought, Sonari, what has America and American business learned from GM's bankruptcy?
It's such a unique story that I don't know if there are things you can glean. I don't think a bailout like this happens in our lifetime again. I don't think that that there is the political will to do this again. I mean, this is a one off. This people, you know, when I was driving through Ohio and Indiana and Iowa, people really for the campaign, you really got the sense that there's not a lot of. People are happy that General Motors is doing well, but there's not a lot of political will to do this again. I can't imagine another company coming back to the government and asking for something like this. That said, what is interesting about I've always thought about the auto industry is there's this funny idea that we have about American products, and it's still sort of prescient in our time, which is that we somehow have sort of thought that maybe they're not so good. And I find that sort of hilarious to me to think that Americans can't make a product as good as anyone else. And I think that as people, especially here on the West Coast where I'm at, as people are, you know, you ask someone like, oh, you got that Impala or you have that Chevy Volt or whatever it is, what do you think of it? And they're like, I was just so surprised. And what's funny to me is like you're surprised that Americans can make a good product. Mm-hmm. I think that the American auto industry so soured people on their products that there's so much room for surprise about, you know, the great things about what American technology and innovation can do, and these companies, all three of them. Have, I think, a long way to go in terms of the future and how they sort of reconnect to America, but also how they redefine our future. But I think that really this is a unique story, and I don't think that this is not something we're going to see again.
I would agree with Sonari, and I would agree with Sonari mainly because I think the car companies aren't going to let this happen again. When you face death, which GM and Chrysler and frankly Ford did, because if those two companies had gone down, the auto supply sector upon which Ford relied would have gone down. We came perilously close to losing our entire American auto industry. And so I do not believe any of these companies, especially GM, is going to lose sight of the fact they have to make money. They have to be profitable. They have to be efficient. And they have to make really great products that are just as good or better, preferably better, than the competitors.
Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Samilton and business reporter Sonari Glinton joining us from NPR West in Los Angeles. Thanks so much to both of you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
If there's an issue you want to hear more about, do let us know. We'd like to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And you can find us at michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Saadeh, Katie Suha, Jeff Warniak, and Chrissy Zamron. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.